Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Christian, in virtue of being a Christian, is a philosopher. The only question is whether he's going to be a good one. I identify Adam and Eve as being members of this species. When he started pressing me about the resurrection of Jesus and I started laying out the evidence, he retreated very quickly.
Why did God allow Jesus to suffer so much?
Because...
Which argument used to defend Christianity do you find the weakest?
The worst argument. Well, I suppose I would say the argument from...
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, that's quite the teaser, isn't it? If you want to hear the answers to those questions, keep listening, because we are bringing you the live Ask William Lane Craig Anything show that Ruth Jackson and I were joined by hundreds of Unbelievable listeners for last week. And if you want more from the show, all your unbelievable needs can be met by visiting premierunbelievable.com. As well as having some time for your feedback later on the show, I'll also be playing a preview of another of our upcoming big conversation shows, Louise Perry and Rod Dreher discussing Christendom and the sexual revolution. Boy, we've got some great stuff coming for you. For now, here's a live show recorded just a week and a half ago with William Lane Craig. Well, hello and welcome along to today's Premier Unbelievable Live. I'm Justin Brierley, joined by my co-host Ruth Jackson, and we'll introduce our special guest in just a moment's time. But hello, Ruth.
Hi. Good, I don't know why I'm here, shouting. I have a microphone. I don't need to shout.
Well, look, we'll do what we always do and say lots of people joining us here for today's live webinar. Why not tell us in the chat where you're joining from? We'd love to know where you're watching or listening from all over the world. And we'll read out a few of those in a moment's time. But our special guest on today's show is, of course, William Lane Craig, Christian philosopher, author and founder of Reasonable Faith, a ministry that engages skeptics and equips Christians to understand and defend their faith. He's been described as the one Christian apologist who seems to have put the fear of God into many of my fellow atheists. That was atheist Sam Harris. And Bill is arguably the world's leading academic defender of Christian belief.
Yeah, Bill has debated dozens of atheists and non-Christians over the years, and he's published over 50 books, 200 peer-reviewed articles. And this is an incredible fact. His Kalam cosmological argument is the most studied argument for God in contemporary Western philosophy. This live event is your opportunity to ask the William Lane Craig anything. So do have a think about what questions or objections you've got about your Christian faith that you find the most challenging or important.
Absolutely. Now, you may be a Christian tuning in. You may be not a non-Christian, a skeptic. We would love to hear from everybody across the board. Do please submit your questions. Now, it's very easy to do that here on Zoom. There's a Q&A function, and that's the way to do it. We won't see your questions necessarily if you just put them in the chat. So put them in the Q&A. When we will then filter some of those questions, select the ones that we're going to try and ask Bill. So if you see that your question says it's been answered but hasn't yet been answered, it's just because we're filtering it so that we've got it ready to ask Bill. So do feel free, as we open up the conversation with Bill, to start putting your questions into the Q&A functionality. But welcome along, Bill. How are you doing?
Thank you. Very well, I'm pleased to say. It's good to be with you.
It's been a little while since we had you on the show. Normally, obviously, it's in our pre-recorded format. Probably, I think it was back in lockdown, the early days of lockdown, that we had you on for a live show. So it's been a little while that we've been able to do something like this with a live audience. Tell us what you've been up to recently. You've always got a new project, some research on the go. What's currently going on?
What is going on now is that for the last 2 years, I have been working on my magnum opus, which is a systematic philosophical theology of the Christian religion. I've been in this now for 2 years, and every day I am writing and reading and working on this systematic theology. It has become something of a magnificent obsession for me, and occupies almost all my time.
Fantastic, fantastic. What are some of the highlights? I mean, looking back on your career, Bill, you've obviously turned your attention to many different areas of study, but you've also been engaged in some fascinating encounters over the years. Yeah. Are there any sort of particular highlights that come to mind as you think about some of the stages you've shared with well-known personalities, both with and without faith?
Well, in terms of my academic work as a philosopher, I have specialized on what's called the coherence of theism, which is a philosophical study of the attributes of God. And I think my study of divine eternity, that is to say, God's relationship to time, and then divine aseity, that is to say, God's self-existence, have been especially rewarding, just profoundly rich studies that have increased my understanding so much of who God is and what he's like and how he relates to our world. So on the academic side, I think those two areas stand out. In terms of the speaking ministry, I have loved some of the tours that I have done of the UK, debating at places like the Cambridge Union and the Oxford Debating Society, as well as in London and various universities around the nation. It's just been wonderful to have that sort of experience in Great Britain.
Well, we've so loved having you. Bill, one of the questions we'd love to ask is around, you know, what do you think the current state of apologetics is in the church? I guess with a capital C, because you do lots of stuff with lots of different churches. I mean, are you pleased with the way that the churches are engaging with the intellectual side of faith, would you say?
Well, I think there is a significant minority movement within the church today that is very interested in intellectually engaging with our culture. And that is tremendously encouraging. On the other hand, I do think it still tends to be the minority. I think that for the average Christian, he's just too preoccupied with his rebellious teenagers or a failing marriage or financial pressures or job and other worries to be much concerned about these intellectual questions. And so it's still difficult to motivate people to really become intellectually engaged with their faith.
I do get the sense, though, that for me, just in the time that I've been running The Unbelievable Show, and The Unbelievable Show started really in the heyday of the new atheism, it felt like the church was perhaps caught on the back foot by that very dogmatic anti-theism that movement represented. And I do feel like ministries like yours and others have really grown up in response to that. So I think we're in, you know, there's a lot more general awareness, at least, of apologetics and an intellectual defense of faith than there was, let's say, 15 to 20 years ago, Bill. Yeah. I don't know if that's your experience.
Well, and that's certainly true, Justin, in the academy. I was speaking in the pew, in the church pew, but in the academy, oh my goodness, the Renaissance of Christian philosophy and New Testament studies and physics and so forth has just been tremendously encouraging. And my hope and prayer is that this will filter down to the man in the pew in the coming generations, and that he also will become more intellectually engaged with his faith. And as you mentioned, the conferences in apologetics that are often hosted today, Premier has done several of these. The attendance has been tremendous compared to 20 years ago. So that is very encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't help but ask as well, Bill, because it's such a wonderful feature of your background. There's a skull on the shelf behind you. Would you mind telling us, or even bringing it down, so that you could tell us exactly why there is this hominid skull in the background?
Okay, just a second.
Bill's just reaching for the skull now, bringing it forward. Here it is.
My most recent book was In Quest of the Historical Adam. And this is a life-size replica of the skull of Homo heidelbergensis, which was discovered at Broken Hill Mine in Rhodesia. And I identify Adam and Eve as being members of this species of Homo heidelbergensis, which lived around 750,000 years ago. And so my wife, Jan, bought me this replica skull for my birthday last year, and it is one of my favorite possessions.
Oh, well, wow. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. What a great artifact to have on the shelf behind you. Well, we may get some questions about Adam and Eve, which, of course, has been a major part of your research in recent years, Bill. Mm. And if anyone wants to go back in the archives, you had a wonderful conversation with Joshua Swammerdas around the time that your book released on that subject. So that's worth going and looking for.
Well, just before we hear more about Equip, I just want to say where some of you are all watching from. We've got Singapore, where apparently it's 4 a.m. So thank you so much for your commitment. South Africa, Munich, Philippines, France. We've got lots of people in the US, England, Scotland, France, Canada, Sydney, Finland. I feel like we've got sort of almost every country represented. But Bill, do tell us more about Equip, because it sounds very exciting.
This is a program designed to train especially young people in the art of articulating and defending what they believe as Christians. And these series of courses are based upon these very special Zangmeister videos that we've developed at Reasonable Faith on various arguments for the existence of God, objections to theism, the evidence for Jesus, and objections to Christian exclusivism. And we've developed 7 of these courses so far based on these videos, and they're layered so that the student will be gradually taken through these from one level to another. And along the way, he will take quizzes to test his comprehension of the material. Now, nobody's grading you. You're not going to flunk out or anything like that. But they are a measure to make sure that the student is grasping the material. And so this is a way of trying to make this vast body of work that I've accumulated available to folks in a simple, digestible way that is very usable.
Wonderful. Thank you so
much. During the next year now, we're going to be developing 7 more of these courses, expanding the curriculum.
That's fantastic. I just love the way in which, you know, we can use the internet in these ways, and it sounds like a really excellent way of unpacking and going deeper with some of the stuff that you've already obviously popularized so widely, Bill. We will make sure that you get the link to Equip. You'll get a follow-up email after today's seminar, which will include a link to find out more about that if you'd like to. We are obviously going to be taking your questions tonight, so do keep those questions coming in, and we're going to get to them in just a moment's time, because that's what we're doing tonight, Ask William Lane Craig Anything. Just before we do that, though, we do want to make you aware of some stuff from our end at Premier Unbelievable, especially the fact that this ministry, of course, does depend on your generous support. We are a listener and viewer supported ministry. We've got something special, actually, for those who would like to support the ministry from today's show. If you click the link in the chat with today's show to donate, you'll actually receive as a thank you an exclusive ebook featuring the big conversation between William Lane Craig and leading physicist Roger Penrose. They had a conversation with me on the universe and God. It was a fantastic, I'm sure, Bill, you remember this conversation.
Oh, very well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this special ebook includes a full transcript of that conversation, but also additional essays and features that were written about it by various commentators. And it's yours as a thank you when you give from today's webinar, or indeed if you're listening or watching at a later date, that link will still work to give. So that link is in the chat now. You will also receive it once this webinar ends and by email as well. So we would love, if you feel able to support the ministry, we would love to send you that as a thank you. Thank you so much for doing that as you do that. Right, probably time that we started to ask you a few questions, Bill.
Great.
And they have been flooding in. My goodness, we normally get a lot of questions, but tonight we've already got
72 questions.
Well, at nearly 100 actually, if you include the ones that we've selected
of
as well.
Course, yes.
So we're already well underway here, and so we apologise, we won't get to all the questions tonight. But why don't we start with one that I think, you know, is a good introductory question. Carter Yancey wants to know, Bill, many Christians are skeptical that faith needs philosophy. How would you explain to a Christian who's skeptical of philosophy why you think it is important? Why don't we start there?
I think in virtue of being a Christian, you are committed to certain philosophical theses. For example, the existence of God, the objectivity and the knowability of truth, the objectivity of moral values, I would say the reality of the soul and life beyond the grave. All of these are enormous and important philosophical commitments, and they're part and parcel of the Christian faith. So every Christian, in virtue of being a Christian, is a philosopher. The only question is whether he's going to be a good one or not. And so I think that all of us, as part of Christian discipleship, of being learners of Jesus, which is what disciple means, need to love the Lord our God with all our mind and to exercise our minds in the understanding of Christian doctrine.
Thank you.
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like lots of people will resonate with this question here from Donald, who says, I have an adult son who is a deconstructed Christian. He was formerly a strong Christian leader, deeply engaged in ministry and evangelism. After college, he began to ask questions that his religious spiritual peer group could not answer. And over a period of time, he reached a decision point that he claims to be materialist, not believing in God, spiritual beings, or a human soul. And he goes on to say, please recommend an approach to begin a conversation on the reality of God and the resurrected Jesus. And as I say, Bill, I feel like lots of people will have a similar experience where just not even knowing where to start that conversation with a former Christian, deconstructed Christian.
Yes. Well, what a shame that he was looking to his peer group for guidance rather than to truth. And I would recommend my book On Guard for a Beginner, which lays out the importance of the question of God and then gives a number of arguments as to why we should believe in a transcendent, personal creator and designer of the universe who is the locus of absolute moral value. And then it also gets into the subject of whether or not this transcendent creator and designer has revealed himself decisively in the person of Jesus. So that would be a great place to begin. If one wants to go deeper, my book, Reasonable Faith, is then a more intermediate level to which one might graduate after doing On Guard.
That's really helpful, Bill. Thank you. Here's an interesting question from John, who says, Dr. Craig, which argument used to defend Christianity do you find the weakest or even harmful? And have you ever had to change your mind on an issue or an argument? It's not a question that often comes up. Normally it's what's the best one, you know, but yeah. Have you heard bad ones that you would say, no, that's really not a good way of defending faith?
Well, I've certainly changed my mind on certain issues. For example, I once thought that the cosmological argument from contingency was not sound because it depended upon a very strong principle of sufficient reason that seemed to me to be self-defeating. And it wasn't until I read Stephen Davis's defense of the contingency argument that I became persuaded that this, in fact, is a sound argument for God and have since defended it. Similarly, I thought that the ontological argument was not a sound argument for God's existence, that it was an attempt to define God into existence, until I read Alvin Plantinga's Nature of Necessity, and became convinced that this is a sound and plausible argument for God's existence. So yes, I have changed my mind on certain key issues like that. Now, the worst argument, well, I suppose, I mean, besides thinking of just utterly invalid or fallacious argument, I would say the argument from fulfilled prophecy is one that is hard to make, because you have to show that the prophecy was intended to speak of these events in the future. And then you have to show that those events actually did historically occur in fulfillment of that prophecy. And that's very difficult to do. So I think the argument from fulfilled prophecy is one that is hard to put through.
It's tougher to defend, yes. I suppose any argument as well can be formulated in ways that are better or worse. And so you inevitably get people who make a real hash of what could be a fairly good argument for God.
Yes, and that is the lesson of the contingency argument or the ontological argument. Certainly there are invalid or unsound forms of those arguments, but that doesn't mean that the core of the argument is incapable of being properly and cogently articulated.
Well, this might be an opportunity to hold up your skull, Bill. So I'll just give you a pre-warning there. This is a question from Sheila, which, I would imagine, again, is echoed by lots of people. She says, here's a big one, Bill. My husband believes that the Adam and Eve story is a myth. He is a scientist. However, I can think of no better explanation of how sin entered the world, assuming that creation was originally perfect, than that so-called myth. What do you think?
I think that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are quasi-mythical. That is to say, I think that they exhibit many of the characteristics of what folklorists and classicists called myth. Now, I hasten to add that when I use that word, I am not talking about myth in the popular sense of the word, of a falsehood, like the myth of the low-calorie diet or the myth of the self-made man. Rather, for classicists and folklorists, myths are narratives that feature deities that attempt to ground the values and institutions in the author's current society in events in the deep primordial past. And certainly Genesis 1 to 11 is aimed at doing precisely that. Now, it's characteristic of myth as a literary genre that it is full of figurative language or symbols that need not be taken literally. And I think that's exactly what you find in Genesis 1 to 11. The starkest example of this is the description of God in Genesis 2 and 3 as some sort of a humanoid physical person walking in the cool of the day in the garden looking for Adam and Eve in the bushes. This is clearly an anthropomorphic description of God, whom the author of the Pentateuch believes to be an incorporeal, transcendent being who in the beginning created the heavens and the earth. So I would agree with her husband that it is quasi-mythical, and that's not a threat to the truth of these narratives. But I would add that it is mytho-historical. The presence of the genealogies that transform these primeval stories into a primeval history showed that there is definitely a historical interest on the part of the author of the Pentateuch, and that just as he indisputably regarded Abraham and his descendants as historical, so he thought that Abraham's ancestors were historical. So I see Genesis 1 to 11 as an intriguing, fascinating blend of myth and history, real people, real events, but described in the figurative and metaphorical language of myth.
Well, let's stick with that theme, because David Harris wants to ask, I recently read some sections of your new book on the historicity of Adam and really enjoyed it. My question is, as I rethink Genesis 1 to 11, I am moving away from a literalistic reading And this has led me to wonder how best to find meaning in these passages. If a literalistic approach is not the best way, and I agree with you on this, then how do I read these well? And what are perhaps some resources you recommend to help me pursue the intended meaning of these passages?
I think what you need to ask yourself as you read the narratives is, what is the theological point that the author of the Pentateuch is trying to make? For example, clearly in chapter one, the point is that the things of nature, the stars and the planets, the animals and the vegetation are not gods, nor infused with God. Rather, they are just natural products that are the creation of the transcendent creator of the universe. And so it results in a desacralized view of nature. Nature is not full of gods. It's not a haunted house, and therefore is open to rational exploration and discovery. So it struck me forcefully that the desacralization of nature that paved the way for modern science, that is often credited to the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers, pride of place belongs to these Hebrew authors of Genesis 1 to 11, particularly Genesis 1, who enunciated a desacralized view of nature, which is the natural product of this transcendent creator. And so look to see what is the point that the author is trying to make. Let me give you an analogy that may be helpful. Jesus' parables were not meant to be taken literally. These were not historical stories. They were stories that he made up to illustrate a point. And I think in almost every case, it's pretty obvious what the point of the parable is trying to teach. You read the parable and say, what is it that Jesus is trying to teach by the story of the Good Samaritan, or the story of the prodigal son? And in the same way that you can see the central point that this parable teaches, even though it's not literal, nevertheless, I think you can do the same thing with Genesis 1 to 11 and see the central theological points that emerge there. And I list 10 such points in my quest for the historical Adam.
You're listening to Unbelievable. Today's live show was recorded recently with Christian thinker William Lane Craig answering listener questions. And he can.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Continues to answer questions on the historical Adam and Eve in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show, recorded live with Christian thinker William Lane Craig and hundreds of Unbelievable listeners. Ruth Jackson continues to ask your questions.
Well, there's another question on this topic, and then perhaps we might take some from a slightly different route. This is from James in Brighton, and he says, How can all humans be descended from Adam and bear the image of God, considering the geographical fossil evidence of humanoids being so widely distributed throughout the globe?
Well, this requires you to push the date of Adam and Eve very far into the past. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that I identified Adam and Eve as members of the species Homo heidelbergensis, or Heidelberg man. Heidelberg man was the common ancestor of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. He was the stem species from which Neanderthals and Homo sapiens emerged. So by placing Adam and Eve in the deep past, around 750,000 years ago, that gives ample time for Heidelberg man to diffuse throughout the world, and indeed his skeletons are found throughout the world. And he migrated into Africa, into the Middle East and Europe, and in Africa evolved into Homo sapiens. In Europe and Asia, he evolved into Neanderthals. So that problem of geographical distribution is met by having a sufficiently early date for these persons.
One more question before we move on. And there's a fantastic amount of chat going on today. Very lively in the chat this evening. Lots of back and forth on the nature of Genesis as we've been talking it through, Bill. But here's just one more from Jonathan, who says, I commend your book, In Quest for the Historical Adam, as I believe this work was done with the utmost integrity, sincerity, and objective scholarship. My question is this: has the content of that book made you question any other material within other works you've published? Would you change or adjust any material from past publications?
Yes, thank you for that question. It did cause me to revise one important view that I had. As a result of my study of the resurrection of Jesus, I concluded that physical human death is the result of sin, and that it is because of the fall of Adam that human beings are mortal and need the resurrection to solve that problem. As a result of my study of the historical Adam, I came to the conclusion that that view is in fact wrong. I think that Adam and Eve were created mortal, just like any ordinary biological organisms. They would have eventually died if they lived long enough in the garden. And evidence for that is the fact that if they were naturally immortal, there was no reason to have the tree of life in the garden. Mm. The tree of life was there because it was a sort of fountain of youth, as it were, that would continually rejuvenate them. And when they fell into sin, they were expelled from the garden precisely so that they wouldn't eat of the tree of life. Moreover, you notice that when God says, in the day you eat of it, you will surely die, and yet they don't drop over dead when they sin, but they are immediately spiritually alienated and estranged from God. And that suggests that the death spoken of there is spiritual death that ensues from sin, not physical death. And so when you go to the New Testament, it's so interesting. In Romans 5, Paul is talking about spiritual death. And what is the remedy for spiritual death? It's justification. Justification remedies spiritual death. But in 1 Corinthians, where he's talking about physical death, what is the remedy for physical death? It's not justification, it's resurrection from the dead. So the resurrection remedies the mortality that we share and conquers physical death, but the answer to spiritual death is not resurrection, it's justification.
Fantastic.
So that was a major change.
Brilliant. Well, let's move on. I mean, there may well be some more questions about Adam and Eve coming in, but if we move just a little bit, lots of people have been talking about artificial intelligence recently, particularly ChatGPT. We've got a question in here from Aaron, which says, do you find any utility in artificial intelligence, such as ChatGPT? Have you experimented with it much? But I guess, yeah, what do you think about it, Bill? What's your opinion on artificial intelligence?
Okay, I need you to repeat the question because your screen temporarily froze and I didn't hear the question.
Oh, I do apologize. Do you find any utility in artificial intelligence such as ChatGPT, and have you experimented with it much?
I haven't. I prefer to do my own research rather than to ask some artificial intelligence. I think it can be useful when you want to know certain geographical facts or what's on the telly or who's playing, you know, Manchester on the weekend or something. But when it comes to really serious things, I don't think you should use it. I noticed that somebody actually reconstructed a debate through artificial intelligence between me and Richard Dawkins. Hmm. And when I read it, I thought, man, if I did that bad, I would be ashamed of myself against Richard Dawkins. So I don't think this artificial intelligence was very intelligent at all.
Well, sticking with that, I mean, one of the questions that I think this new technology and the fact that it does seem to have come up on in leaps and bounds in recent years has raised, Bill, is whether we are approaching some sense in which technology itself, computers and so on, could in some sense become intelligent in the human sense, in yeah. having meaning and purpose and agency and you know, being able to associate ideas in a meaningful way. Do you think we'll ever get to that point where there is a sort of human level intelligence coming
I'm
out of technology?
I'm not equipped to say, Justin. my opinion wouldn't be worth anything on this because I am simply not expert on AI.
Well, here's a related question then, one that I know you have thought about a bit more, which is from Michael, who says, what, Bill, is your theory of consciousness? Specifically, Michael wants to know supervenience with regards to mental and physical properties. Uh-huh. And do near-death experiences affect your view of consciousness at all?
I haven't been very persuaded by what I know about near-death experiences. But it seems to me that we want to say that the soul is the seat of consciousness and is a substance distinct from the body. If you say that the soul or consciousness is merely supervenient upon the brain, then that is incompatible with mental causation, because in that case, all the causation is from physical brain state to physical brain state. And consciousness just rides along on the surface in a causally impotent way. And so there is no mental causation. For the same reason, there is no freedom of the will, because these mental states have no ability to do anything. Everything is determined physically by the brain states and the stimuli that they receive. There would, as a result, be no moral agency either, because the deterministic outcomes of brain states are not morally significant. It's hard to explain intentionality on this basis either, that I have the ability to think about things that don't even exist. So for all of these reasons, I think it's very important to maintain that whatever the relationship between the mind and the brain, the mind is more than just a supervenient reality. It can be correlated with brain states, but I don't think we can say that it's simply supervenient on them.
Well, Bill, we've had quite a lot of questions, understandably, in an event like this around suffering and evil. How would you approach the question of suffering? If God is good, if he exists, why would he allow suffering?
I like to draw a distinction between the intellectual problem of suffering and the emotional problem of suffering. The intellectual problem is how to reconcile the existence of an all-loving, all-powerful God with the horrible evil and suffering in the world. The emotional problem consists of how to dissolve people's dislike of a God who would allow them or others to suffer so. And I'm persuaded, Ruth, as I talk to folks, that for most people, the problem of suffering is not really an intellectual problem. They've never really thought about it deeply. It's an emotional problem, and therefore needs to be resolved, I think, in an emotionally. intellectually, I would say that the problem of suffering and evil puts a burden of proof on the atheist's shoulder that is so heavy that it is unsustainable. The atheist has to show that it is either impossible or highly improbable that God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the suffering and evil we see. And that involves probability judgments way beyond our ability to make with any sort of confidence. So I don't think there is a good intellectual objection to the existence of an all-powerful and all-good God based on evil and suffering in the world. Now, the emotional problem still remains, however, and there I would say that those who are going through terrible suffering need to meditate upon the cross of Christ. When we meditate on the cross of Christ, we see that God himself took upon himself in Christ incomprehensible suffering, even though he was totally innocent. And why did he do it? Because he loves us so much and so was willing to bear that suffering that we deserved as the punishment for our sins in order to redeem us and bring us into an eternal relationship with himself, far more wonderful than we could ever think or imagine. And I think when we think about the extent of his love and what he was willing to endure for us, that can give us the emotional strength and courage to bear the cross that God asks us to bear during this finite human existence.
I'll ask a follow-up question to that, Bill. James asks, well, so first of all, says thank you for your amazing commitment to upholding truth. But James works with a youth group in a church in Brighton and says, could you help me explain as simply as possible a response to their question, why would God, being all-powerful, create a world with sin and suffering in it? Why allow so much pain? And perhaps this is another the question, why not just skip straight to heaven? Why do we have to go through this veil of
well,
suffering?
I think that the second question provides the key to the first.
Okay.
Heaven is not something that God imposes upon people independently of their free will. Rather, this world is a veil of decision-making in which we are allowed to freely determine our own eternal destiny by freely choosing for God or against God. And so God isn't some kind of a divine rapist who imposes himself upon us. And therefore, he cannot simply send everybody to heaven, which would violate their freedom of the will. Now, what that means is that God has created a world at a certain epistemic distance from himself, a certain arm's length from himself, so that he doesn't overwhelm our free wills by his glory and power. And I think, Justin, honestly, it is not at all improbable that only in a world suffused with natural and moral evil, would the optimal number of people freely come to know God and embrace his salvation. And so I think God's overriding aim in human history is to bring as many people as possible into the kingdom of God freely, with as little loss as possible, and that doing that may well require permitting enormous amounts of suffering and evil in the world.
It's such an interesting way of looking at it, Bill. I've heard something that sort of sounds similar that I think goes back to Alvin Plantinga, where he talked about the fact that sometimes people object to, you know, that there are other possible worlds, for instance, where we could have had a world with slightly less suffering or something, and God would still have, you know, been able to fulfill his purposes. But I think Plantinga's response to that was, it's just possible that a world in which Christ had to come in and die a sacrificial death, demonstrating that the greatest possible love possible, is the best of all possible worlds that we're actually living in, despite the, you know, all the evidence that appears to be to the contrary. The fact that it's a world which required Christ's sacrifice and the great good that exists in and of itself is in fact an indicator that we may well be living in the best of all possible worlds because of what Christ has done in that sense.
Plantinga's hypothesis is so interesting because On this view, the self-sacrificial atoning death of Christ for our sins is an incommensurable good, so that when you weigh different possible worlds against each other, worlds that include this incommensurable good far outweigh these worlds without it. Now, think about that. In order for Christ to die for your sins, the world has to be full of sin, and therefore evil would be a concomitant automatically of the atoning death of Christ. So that is really an interesting perspective, and I think is one that is well worth consideration.
Well, just on that, before we move away from suffering, because as I said, there's lots of different questions around this. Mark Bashir has said this: loving parents don't want to see their children in pain. So why did God allow Jesus to suffer so much?
Because he loves us so much that the Father and the Son agreed that the Son would bear the punishment for our sins so that we might be redeemed and come into this eternal love relationship with God. One of the most popular Bible verses is that God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. So the atoning death of Christ is tremendous testimony to the self-sacrificial love of God, and particularly for Jesus' voluntary self-sacrifice for us.
A bit more of a personal question, Bill, because what you've described is obviously an important part of the Christian understanding of the gospel and what it means to accept Christ. If this pries too much into personal conversations, feel free to say, but Keegan wants to know, what was it like talking to Ben Shapiro, a well-known talk show host who is Jewish himself by background, especially in regards to the gospel? I know that you obviously had an interview on Ben Shapiro's show, Bill. Can you share anything about sort of what you felt, how the conversation went, and how
I can
how
say that I found him to be very congenial, really a friendly, casual fellow, not at all self-important or presumptuous. We really hit it off well. And I noticed that when he started pressing me about the resurrection of Jesus and I started laying out the evidence, he retreated very quickly and changed the subject, which I thought was sort of interesting. But I greatly enjoyed our conversation.
If I could ask one more sort of that's sort of in the realm of people who deal with apologetics online and that sort of thing. You've appeared on Cameron Bertuzzi's channel a few times. He runs the Capturing Christianity YouTube channel and has spoken to many apologists over the years.
Cameron is sort of the Justin Brierley of the United States.
But maybe. I wouldn't like to compare myself to Cameron. But anyway, he's been on an interesting journey. I don't know how much you're aware of this recently, Bill, but he's recently converted to Catholicism. And there does appear to be, says Marco, a renewed interest around Protestantism and Catholicism, and which one is a more faithful representation of Christianity. Well, Marco isn't asking you to comment on Cameron specifically, but ask simply for you, Bill, what are your main reasons for being a Protestant rather than a Catholic?
Mm-hmm. I suppose the primary reason is that I take as my authority for Christian doctrine Scripture alone, sola scriptura, which was the watchword of the Reformation. Any authority that is invested in the church or ecclesiastical tradition or even creedal statements seems to me to be derivative from the Scriptures. And so there are lots of accreted doctrines that I don't think are scriptural, and that I couldn't believe in it, even if I wanted to, like the ascension of Mary into heaven or Mary's Immaculate Conception. The Immaculate Conception was not that Jesus was born without sin, but that was Mary was born without sin. Well, there's no scriptural grounds for that. So while I love and respect Catholic brethren, I couldn't be one of them because I just don't believe those things.
Ruth, do you want to take the next one?
Yeah, there's a really interesting question here from Justin Bennett, who says, as a former Christian, now an agnostic slash atheist, I've watched many of your debates and hold you in high regard as an excellent apologist and orator. But one of the many things I could not reconcile as I was deconstructing was, of all the creator gods there are, how could I continue to believe in Yahweh as the one true God? How do you reconcile this outside of your own personal belief?
Well, I would say that the arguments for the existence of God that I've defended, such as the contingency argument, the Kalam cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument, the moral argument, narrow down the field of the world's religions to basically the great monotheistic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and perhaps deism. But it excludes all of the polytheistic and pantheistic religions. So if these arguments are correct, then you're already down to about only four alternatives. Now, beyond that point, beyond a generic monotheism, I think that you have to look at the person of Jesus of Nazareth and ask, which religion gets Jesus of Nazareth right? And clearly it's not Islam, because Islam denies that Jesus of Nazareth was ever crucified, that he ever died, which is the one indisputable fact about the historical Jesus. Judaism, I think, is fine up until the point of Jesus, but then it doesn't explain who Jesus was, particularly the evidence for his radical personal claims and his resurrection from the dead. If God really did raise Jesus from the dead, then he has unequivocally vindicated those radical personal claims for which he was crucified. And that implies, therefore, that Jesus is the self-revelation of God. And that rules out these other monotheistic faiths, such as Judaism, Islam, and deism. So that, in a nutshell, would be the reason for preferring Christian theism. And I hope that our listener that submitted this question will reconsider those arguments with a view toward coming back to Christ.
I think we've got a number of people who are on different parts of the faith spectrum watching and listening tonight, Bill. Mark, for instance, describes himself as a respectful and curious doctor who has been following your work for some time now. Now, Mark says, I am a theist and a medical doctor. I've often heard stories of miraculous healings and other extraordinary events that are attributed to God's intervention. However, I've noticed that there seems to be an absence of such evidence in the scientific literature. Do you have any thoughts on why there seems to be a lack of empirical evidence for miracles, Bill?
You know, this is really a controverted question. I have a friend in Southampton, Dr. Peter May, whom I know Justin knows.
Well, I'm going to leap in, Bill, because we had Peter on the show just recently debating this very subject with Craig Keener, who I'm sure you're aware. Has been cataloguing modern evidence for miracles. And so they had quite the debate, I can tell you, on that show. Yeah. But yes,
so
I
think for our doctor friend who submitted the question, he needs to be aware that in order to be a Christian, you do not need to believe in contemporary miracles. Even if you think that Peter May is wrong, is overly skeptical, there is absolutely no doubt that this man is a deeply committed Christian who loves Jesus Christ, but he just doesn't think that God is in the business of doing the sort of miracles today that were done through the ministry of his son, Jesus of Nazareth. So this is a question on which Christians are at liberty to disagree. And if he is skeptical of modern medical miracles, that's just fine.
If you don't mind me asking, Bill, where do you fall on that? It's not necessarily something to search greatly, but
I really hope Peter is not right here. I don't want to tie God's hands and say, you can't do this anymore, Lord. I want to be open to miracles. And yet, on the other hand, I have to confess that there are a lot of really spurious miracle claims and that many are poorly attested. I expressed a moment ago some skepticism about near-death experiences, for example. So I'm open-minded. Mm. I'm ready to follow the evidence where it leads, but I don't have a strong view.
Well, we will continue to hear questions that came in for William Lane Craig in our special live show in the final part of today's Unbelievable in just a moment. Do join us again.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show that gets you thinking. Still to come later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, social media influencer Ollie London talks to Sam Hales about his new book, Detransition, a memoir. Ollie has become a significant voice in the transgender debate alongside coming to Christian faith in recent years. On next week's edition of Unbelievable, it's Easter weekend, of course, and to mark that, we have the first episode of Season 5 of The Big Conversation Broadcasting. Noted New Testament scholars Bart Ehrman and Justin Bass debating, did Jesus of Nazareth rise from the dead? And boy, was this a punchy debate. The rise of Christianity, of course, has shaped the modern world, but are its historical origins best explained in purely naturalistic terms? That's Bart's argument, or the explanation the first followers gave that Jesus had risen from the dead. That's where Justin Bass is coming from. New Testament historian Bart Ehrman, of course, doesn't believe in the miraculous claims of the New Testament, including the resurrection of Jesus. Whereas New Testament scholar Justin Bass argues in his book, The Bedrock of Christianity, for a number of facts concerning the death and resurrection of Jesus that point to its truth. So they'll be debating scripture, history, and the resurrection. But here's the good news. You can watch that right now, a whole week early, by simply subscribing at thebigconversation.show. You'll be the first to see it. If you go to thebigconversation.show, subscribe, you can get hold of it a whole week early. By the way, later on in the show, also going to be playing a preview of the second episode of The Big Conversation, Louise Perry and Rod Dreher, in conversation on Christianity, the sexual revolution, and the future of the West. And I did mention a big announcement coming this week as well. Well, due to circumstances beyond my control, I can't actually bring you that announcement this week after all. I'm so sorry to be so mysterious, but I will be able to share it in a few weeks' time on the show when we'll be celebrating 17 and a half years of Unbelievable. So let's get back to the final questions that came in for William Lane Craig on our recent live show. Here's Ruth Jackson picking up the conversation.
Well, Bill, you mentioned near-death experiences there, but there's a question, I guess, kind of related to that from Gay Vivian, who says, Dr. Craig, can you tell me what happens to us when we die, including the final resurrection?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you what the Bible says. What it says is that when your physical body dies and decays, yourself or soul, that immaterial aspect of your being, goes to be either with God, if you are a regenerate and redeemed person, or it goes into a situation of separation from God. And it will stay in that intermediate state until the end of the universe, when God, so to speak, rolls up the scroll of human history and brings our space-time continuum to an end and inaugurates a new heavens and a new earth. And it will be at that time, at the end of the age, that the dead will be raised and that they will be reunited with an immortal, everlasting, supernatural, spiritual body, and then taken into the new heavens and the new earth, if they are indeed children of God or separated from God forever.
Bill, we are rapidly approaching the end of our time, and you've answered all these questions so well, and that you haven't seen any of these in advance, of course. So thank you for the excellent job you're doing. This is just maybe finishing with a couple of slightly lighter ones, because we've done some deep thinking today. Zoe has a question. If you could have a coffee and a chat with anyone from the Bible except for Jesus, who would you choose and why?
Most certainly, Paul. I am in awe of the Apostle Paul. This man was a genius, a brilliant thinker, and moreover, what a soldier. What a brave man. When you think of how he was stoned and whipped and beaten, and yet every time would get up and go on to the next city and proclaim the gospel, I'm just in awe of someone with this kind of courage and perseverance. So I would love to sit down with the Apostle Paul and have a coffee.
Yeah, so it'd be his first time having coffee, I imagine, as he lived 2,000 years ago. But maybe he'll get to experience it in the new creation. Well, it's been fascinating. Maybe we've time for one more, and I wonder if I can just put this last one to you, because you were, in a sense, have devoted your life to making the case for faith for a new generation of Christians today, and indeed skeptics who are interested in inquirers. But Andy wants to say, I'm a full-time pastor, Bill, with 5 young children. What advice do you have for parenting while also serving in full-time ministry, which, as you know, can be very challenging? I want my kids to know and love Jesus and love and belong to a local church as adults. Any advice from yourself as a father yourself, Bill?
Yes, what I want to say to our fathers out there is that you fathers need to take ownership of instructing your children in Christian doctrine and apologetics, very simply at first from a young age, but then with increasing depth as they grow older. Do not leave this to mom or to the Sunday school to do. The image of a male figure, a loving but authoritative father committed to the truth of Christian doctrine and training his children, has a tremendous and, I think, life-lasting impact upon those kids. So start early, and you fathers take responsibility for doing this. One tool that we've tried to develop for doing this is our cartoon booklets called What is God Like? Featuring Brown Bear and Red Goose, who teach their little children the attributes of God, what God is like. And it is a great way to start a conversation with your kids about things like God's being all-knowing or being eternal or all-powerful or what happens when you die. So those are our attempt to provide some tools for young children to begin their training very early.
Fantastic. Well, that probably does draw our time to a close. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking on all of those questions. I hope that if your question didn't get answered, well, don't worry, because you can always submit questions to Bill's own website. There's lots of opportunities to engage with Bill. And of course, you should go and read some of the many books that he's written as well. We are going to make sure there's links both to the Equip course that we mentioned earlier and to Bill's website coming to you in an email. So you'll be able to access that as soon as you receive that. Just to say, as we start to finish off as well tonight, as well as receiving that information, we will also be sending you the link if you would like to make a donation to our own ministry, Premier Unbelievable. Just another quick mention that if you're able to do that from today's show, the link is in the chat right now, and you will receive as a thank you that special ebook, The Big Conversation, that Bill shared with Roger Penrose, who is a Nobel Prize winning physicist, of course, on the universe. Where did it come from and why are we part of it? That includes their whole conversation, plus additional essays and articles that reflect on that. Bill, that was a fantastic conversation, wasn't it? I just have such good memories of
what
when you came to do that.
What an honor to talk with Sir Roger Penrose. It was fabulous and a great discussion. He said to me afterwards, some of the things that you raised, I never thought of before. Now, that is quite a compliment. So it was great.
We're looking forward to a new season of The Big Conversation starting very soon here on the show. So look out for that. And if you are able to give, and we'll send, then we will send as a thank you that ebook as well. But for the moment, Bill, thank you so much for being our guest on the show today.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. Ruth, thank you for co-hosting as well. We're looking forward to seeing this show air. It'll be going out on podcast and video on the 31st of March. So look out for that. You can watch it again, share it with your friends. So do make sure to look out for that when it drops. But for the moment, we'll say thank you, good night, and God bless and we'll see you again next time. And again, just to reiterate, that link, if you'd like to give towards the work of Premier Unbelievable, still open, link from today's show, and you can get that special ebook of William Lane Craig and Roger Penrose in conversation, along with many other articles and essays, as a thank you for your gift. And if you'd like to get in touch, as ever, you can do that by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/premierunbelievable, or @unbelievablefe for the Twitter account. Well, why don't we go to some of your feedback in just a moment's time? But first, why don't we hear from another snippet of an upcoming big conversation? I'm really excited about this one as well, because not only next week do we kick off with Bart Ehrman and Justin Bass on the resurrection of Jesus, but not long after that, we'll be putting out the second episode as well. And we've already released our teaser promo for it. So why don't we hear a little bit of Louise Perry, author of The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, and noted Christian thinker Rod Dreher, talking about Christendom, the sexual revolution, and the future of the West.
Looking at the gap between what I was experiencing during frontline work and what I had been taught as feminist theory shook my faith in feminist theory. We seem to have just abandoned any effort to control men and to constrain male sexuality, which has to be constrained.
As you say so powerfully in this book, the whole sexual revolution has been a boon for caddish men. It's justified by contemporary liberal feminists as being something beneficial for women, but in fact, those who have benefited the most are the ones who have the most contempt for women.
Yeah.
So a very different feel for this second episode that will be coming of the big conversation from our first, between Bart Ehrman and Justin Bass, but such a good listen as well. These videos, by the way, look fantastic. So if you do get a chance at thebigconversation.show, do go and check out the promos for them. And again, you will get this one a week early if you subscribe and register at thebigconversation.show. So that is worth your while doing. Okay. Thanks to all those who have been in touch. Loads of response, by the way, to last week's show. Grace Hill and Eric Huffman joined me to talk about Grace being a skeptic in church and her questions around the exclusive claims of Christianity. So we'll come to those in just a moment's time. First, a thanks to Wilhelmina, who said the show with William Lane Craig was truly wonderful. Wilhelmina attended live. Thank you so much. 1 hour was too short. I know it always is, isn't it, Wilhelmina? And thanks to all the others who sent in their thanks for that show. Thanks also to Bill Clark, who gets in touch to say thank you for your podcast and excellent work in moving forward important discussions surrounding the veracity of the Christian faith. I've become a regular listener of Unbelievable and have found it helpful in both my life and ministry. Well, all of my life is ministry, really. For the past 40 plus years, my wife and I have been ministering to university students with the Navigators. For most of the past 30 years, we've been doing this in Bulgaria. In order to be able to minister to students and faculty as an insider, I completed a PhD in 2005 so I could teach at the American University in Bulgaria. I've been a professor there since 2007, teaching introductory biology, environmental science, and on occasion, a philosophy course on religion and science. The Unbelievable podcast has been especially useful as I prepare lectures and classroom discussions in the religion and science course. One of the things I tell my students is that they should know, one, what they believe, two, why they believe it, and three, the best arguments against what they believe, and four, the best counter-arguments against those arguments. And your podcast does this brilliantly. I tend to be a flaming radical moderate, striving to remember there's almost always another side to an issue, and that listening to and understanding other viewpoints is essential to moving a discussion forward. Your even-handedness, graciousness, and genuine regard for the dignity of your guests has been a positive example and model worth emulating. I was particularly touched by a fairly recent podcast, or perhaps classic replay, on miracles. I had a delicate surgery in January of 2022 to remove a tumour from my brainstem. Many people were praying for me, and I had a superb surgeon. Since then, I'm again teaching, backcountry skiing and mountain biking. My recovery can easily be explained by the skill of the surgeon and the amazing ability of the body to heal itself, but I know behind or above it all, the Lord was at work. Anyway, thank you for what you do. May the Lord give you an abundance of grace and wisdom as you continue to follow him. Bill Clark, out in Bulgaria, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to come and share on your campus there, Bill. Lovely. I so enjoy hearing and reading of people whose who have found encouragement or benefited in some way from the Unbelievable show. So bless you, Bill. Now, last week's show was, I was blown away actually by how many people have been getting in touch on the back of Grace Hill and Eric Huffman discussing Grace's sort of journey as a skeptic, trying to reconcile her questions in church, Eric as the pastor of the church where she's found a home, and talking about whether Christianity is too exclusive. Here's just a selection of some of the emails that came in. Leah said, "I've listened to your show for several years, and this was hands down one of the best episodes I've heard to date. I was literally in tears hearing that there was someone else out there like me with more questions than it is healthy to be asking. Please have more shows like this one. Don't stop here. If we can reach the youth with open conversations like this one, the modern world would be a much different place. I have a 17-year-old son who's turned away from the non-denominational faith he was raised in because there was no safe place to ask his questions. The only reason I've survived with my faith intact is because I'm tenacious like Grace and have stuck around long enough to start hearing from God directly. I also felt years of silence praying to a wall, like Grace stated. Tell her to hang in there and keep putting facts over feelings. God speaks in whispers, but I also believe he waited for my feeling of frustration to get out of the way of hearing him before I started to become familiar with his voice. More shows on real questions from everyday believers, please, Justin. This was so well done, and the pastor responded with such beauty and peace. Love it. 5 stars. Gosh, thank you, Leah. So glad to know that you found that so helpful. Theo says, listen to Grace Hill and Eric Huffman's deeply raw discussion about skepticism and experience of church. Though before addressing anything else, how beautiful is Eric's voice? Oh yeah, he's got one of those deep voices of authority, I'd say, as Eric. Regards Grace, I can deeply relate, both myself and for the young people I serve in my church, to the secretly ravening hunger of skepticism, which can be so isolating. One of the hallmarks of drowning in skepticism is barely being able to articulate the questions you do have, never mind those you know will be coming down the tracks. The frustration in Grace's voice as she wrestled her way through those thickets was a cathartic moment. I was also comforted by Eric teasing out the recognition that one day, maybe soon, maybe not, one simply has to decide, am I led by faith or doubt? Thanks for all you do, Justin. As you role model mature, honest debate, you're deeply influencing those of us going into the public square and political communication. Can't overstate this. Thank you. Gosh. Again, thank you so much, Theo. And Victor here says, thanks for another great episode. I've been listening for years and I loved the back and forth between Eric and Grace. When Grace started talking about how she questioned praising God for the little things when there's terrible things happening in the world, Eric's response seemed to say that being angry with God was an obstacle in the battle to know him. I don't know if that was his intention. I've had many of the same struggles that Grace has had in my walk with Christ, and I've found that remembering that it's okay to argue with God when you're upset, Job argues with God, and in the end God revealed himself further to Job and he gains wisdom. I love my wife more than anyone in the world, but some arguments need to be had to humble us and cause us to know and love each other more. In arguing with God through prayer, I found that he always seems to point me to Jesus. While I still have many questions, I always have my close personal friend, Saviour and King to talk it through with. Thanks for all you and the team are doing, says Vic. Thanks, Vic. And Dominique says, just listen to that podcast. A skeptical churchgoer asks, is Christianity too exclusive? This was so encouraging to listen to. The conversation between Grace and Eric, it held a mirror to my own journey, past and present. It reminded me of how life-giving it can be when a young woman can sit with a male authority figure and be given the space to wrestle through questions verbally. For an authority figure to take the time to listen with understanding and to respond with life-giving seeds in the moment is such a gift. Incredibly touched by this episode, says Dominique. And Ben says, wow, I did not expect that to turn out how it did. Eric is not wrong that Grace does have quite the gift for articulating questions that most of us choose to put to the side. I think it's possible to get to the place where we ask interminable questions just to disguise our rejection of God. But I didn't get that impression. Eric is amazingly patient and wise pastor, and I can see why he says Grace has helped him to grow. He's a great model for us to emulate insofar as we can do so. Perhaps just one more as well here. Zeke said, Justin, I was touched by the earnest sincerity of Grace's pleading and seeking after the truth. Surely the Lord will honour her heartfelt requests. I was also encouraged by Eric's tender pastoral care for one of his sheep. It was a window into the heart of Jesus. Well done arranging that sacred time, and well done taking a back seat and letting it unfold in front of you with minimal interruption. The Lord brought glory to himself on that show by displaying the gifts he has blessed all three of you with. Blessed be the Lord. I had so many thoughts about what I would ask Grace during the show, but here's my best question for her. Are righteousness and wickedness real categories? In Genesis 18, Abraham and the Lord think they are. Abraham famously bargains with the Lord about saving Sodom. In the end, the number of righteous people required to save Sodom is 10. Abraham understands that the Lord will not treat the righteous and the wicked alike, Genesis 18:25. And Jesus echoes this sentiment in John 5, where he proclaims that an hour is coming when all will hear his voice and come out of their graves. Those who have done good will rise to live, and those who have done evil will rise to be condemned, John 5:28-29. Now, while it's not obvious to us who will be on which side, it will be absolutely obvious to God. The Lord will know everyone who has repented and been blessed by his grace with salvation. It will not be difficult for him to judge. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? Blessings to you, Zeke from Florida. Thank you. Yes, and there were more than that as well. Lots of responses. So thanks for the variety of responses that came in. And I look forward to hearing what you made of today's show as well. There was, of course, an interesting sort of end to the show as Bill talked about the role he sees that men have sometimes given up in raising children. I don't think he meant by that that women don't have a role, of course, just that he too often sees men perhaps not fulfilling their role in spiritual discipleship of children. But if you want to respond to that or anything else that Bill raised, you are, of course, welcome as ever. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Oh, we're still a bit ahead of time, actually. So I tell you what, we've just got time to squeeze in one more little treat. Coming up on Unapologetic, our other podcast this week with Ruth Jackson. As Easter approaches, she's going to be interviewing Jeremiah J. Johnston, who is the pastor for Apologetics out at Prestonwood Church in Texas. He's got a new book out called Body of Proof: The 7 Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. Jeremiah is very much a friend of the show. So why don't we play a little bit of Ruth's conversation with him from The 7 Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus.
The thing in particular that has relevancy for my book is I think we have a new and exciting way to argue for the physical bodily resurrection. And it comes right out of a chapter in my book. I might be skipping ahead. I apologize. There is no psychological motivation for Judaism to invent a resurrection narrative about Jesus if it didn't happen. And I originally published this in a chapter that actually is used in a textbook here in the United States, Macmillan Interdisciplinary Handbook, Philosophy of Religion, where I give 9,000 words on the case for Jesus's resurrection, but I really camped out in this psychological motivation. Judaism is a coherent religion. They believe that there will be a resurrection at the end of days, a general resurrection. In fact, when you read the intertestamental literature, the apocryphal literature, as some call it, Second Maccabees, there's a vibrant belief in life after death. There was no reason to claim that Jesus rose from the dead. You could have honored him as a great prophet, a great thinker, a moral teacher. You had no reason. There's no psychological motivation to go out of bounds and say, hey, he really rose from the dead, because as I said, Judaism is a coherent religion. And so that's something I touch on in the book, and I do much in more depth in my academic writings. But it's an exciting way. That's something I learned in this process. And it's an exciting new, again, area that we can talk about just the reality of the first century world and why we can prove the resurrection of Jesus really happened.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, let's dive in with some of those reasons, because the full title of your book is Body of Proof, The 7 Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. We sort of touched a little bit on the why it matters. So what do you think are the 7 best reasons to believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus? And I guess just quickly before you do that, why did you highlight these 7 rather than, I suppose, you probably had a wealth of other things that you could have picked on?
Absolutely, because I think they're the best 7 reasons to believe in the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus. There are so many good reasons out there. There's more than 7. I think these are the most applicable for today. And, you know, number one is it's the only way you can explain that everywhere the Christian movement goes, society is improved for the better. And I've written a whole other book called Unimaginable, where I trace in 40 pages of single-space font notes the gift that Christianity, it continues to be to the world, in view of the humanitarian aid, the societal impact of the faith, hospitals, healthcare. I mean, Christianity's influence on healthcare is, you can't overemphasize that. The emphasis on family planning, the way that Christianity has stood against infanticide, stood against ill treatment of women and children, you only have Christianity doing that, the idea of individual freedom. And so that's one of the most compelling cases to me is if the resurrection of Jesus inspired the followers of Christ to be full of what we called Christian ethics that were really flew in the face of everybody in the Roman Empire at its time. I mean, Onesimus is the brother. Well, Rome is a slave economy. 40% of the empire were slaves. And you have Paul writing to receive Onesimus as a brother in the Lord who's a slave. So, Paul writes in Galatians 3:28, we're all one in Christ Jesus. We're not male, we're not female, we're all one. And this is the same Paul who would have come out of the school of, Rabbi Judah, better to burn the Torah than teach it to a woman. So you have only Jesus's resurrection can account for this change and for the motivation behind it to care for all people from the womb to the tomb.
So that's one. What's
yes.
two?
Okay. And you got to, so I'll go fast. Number two, Jesus called it. If the church had a hashtag, it would be on the third day. Jesus has this wonderful way and is the Old Testament.
That was Jeremiah J. Johnston talking to Ruth Jackson. You can hear their conversation in full on this week's edition of Unapologetic. You can find it at premierunbelievable.com. It's one of the many podcasts we put out from week to week from Premier Unbelievable. Body of Proof is the new book from Jeremiah. I can see actually it's number one new release in Christian apologetics right now on Amazon. So if you're looking for a great book in the run-up to Easter and beyond, then why not get hold of it and listen out for their show. It releases on Tuesday this coming week. For now, thank you so much for being with me on the show. And as Easter week approaches, I hope that you will know the hope and joy of both Christ's sacrificial death and his resurrection too. And we look forward to you joining us on Easter weekend next time. We'll be putting out the first episode of Season 5 of The Big Conversation as Bart Ehrman and Justin Bass debate, did Jesus of Nazareth rise from the dead? New Testament historian Bart Ehrman doesn't believe in the miraculous claims of the New Testament. New Testament scholar Justin Bass argues in his book, The Bedrock of Christianity, that actually there are a number of facts that point to the truth of the resurrection. They're debating scripture, history, and the resurrection on next week's show. You can get it early though, right now, simply by subscribing at thebigconversation.show. Thanks for being with us this week. See you next time.